William James, who died in 1910, was a professor at Harvard University and a very important person in the history of philosophy. He was also one of the founders of the modern science of psychology. William James was just reaching the end of his career when Sigmund Freud was starting to come into prominence, and they had great admiration for one another, although their ideas were very different. As a psychologist and a philosopher, James was very interested in the relationship between consciousness and material reality, and the role that the mind plays in constructing the world around us. To summarize it very briefly, William James believed that the mind was very important in this process, and there were people who criticized him for that. There were other scholars who thought that he was going too far. One of these people wrote an article in which he said that William James was denying the existence of material reality. He attacked James for teaching that there was no such thing as matter and that everything was mind, which wasn't true, of course, so William James felt he had to respond. So James wrote a letter in which he described a model of reality that was literally based on a hill of beans. Not a hill really, but maybe a handful of beans that you scatter across the top of a table. And James says, those beans are like the material reality that I believe in. I'm not denying reality is definitely out there, just as I would not deny that those beans are lying there on the tabletop. But until my consciousness perceives those beans and interacts with them, they have nothing but the most vague and undefined existence. They're not even beans, because bean is an English word, and the ability to conceptualize a bean depends on all kinds of knowledge and prior experience. To a tiny baby, for example, those things on the table are not beans. The baby sees there's something there, but only in the most basic way. So James said, I agree the beans are definitely lying there on the table. That's material reality. But what else can we say about the beans? Well, a farmer might look at the beans and notice that they are rather small. He may point out the small size of the beans, and he might comment that there must be some problem in growing them. An accountant might look at the beans and immediately start counting them. That's why they're called bean counters. An artist might look at the beans and see all sorts of shapes and relationships between them. We can imagine a shaman looking at the beans and finding some profound meaning or prediction of the future. And we can imagine a different kind of person saying the beans have no significance whatsoever. Then William James asks, which of these people are correct about the beans? Well, they're all correct, because they're all describing the qualities of the beans that their individual consciousness allows them to find there. But that's not all, because this is what people are doing all the time with the world as a whole. If we imagine external reality as just a much larger hill of beans, we can see how a certain kind of person will look at this and notice that some automobiles are larger than others. He'll notice that some houses are larger than others. And because of where his consciousness is at, he may focus on that difference between larger and smaller. He may conclude that it's important to have a larger house rather than a smaller one. And he may even devote his life to making that happen. But what about a person who looked at the beans on the table and saw the shape of a horse? That person might look at the environment as a whole and not even care about which cars are bigger or smaller. He might not even look at the cars and the houses at all. He might prefer to look up at the clouds, and he might think it's very exciting to find the shapes that are there. He might devote his life to painting those shapes. I don't think any of this is particularly difficult to understand. We all interpret the world differently, and we all act in accordance with our interpretation. But it may be that there's also something more going on. Suppose when a person looks at 100 beans that have been thrown across the tabletop, his interpretation is not only an expression of his inner self, but also an influence on the kind of external reality that he will continue to encounter. Suppose his interpretation is also an intention that he projects into space and time. If this is true, it can help us to understand the origins of the incredible synchronicities that take place in our lives. The idea of an intimate relationship between interpretation, intention, and what takes place in the material world has been the basis for many systems of prophecy and divination through the ages. We'll discuss some of them during this session, including the I Ching, which has existed for at least 5,000 years and which has fascinated everyone from Confucius to Carl Jung. But right now, as a way of introducing and developing these themes of prophecy, synchronicity, interpretation and intention, I'd like to relate a memory that my friend Salim Hashim shared with me. For the first 20 years of his life, Salim lived in Africa, in Kenya. When he was very young, he spent a great deal of time with African friends in Nairobi, which is the capital city of Kenya. Salim was very close to a member of the Maasai tribe, who historically have been great warriors and who are also a very spiritual people. The Maasai raise cattle and have an extraordinary affinity with the animals. There can be hundreds of cows, but every one of them has a distinct personality to the Maasai. And of course, everyone has a name. This particular Maasai tribesman whom Salim befriended had been a warrior and had an impeccable spirit about him. Even as a young person, Salim was aware of his sense of presence and warrior bearing. There was one day when Salim was in a bad mood for some reason, and he was spending a lot of time complaining and feeling sorry for himself. He was just a boy, but his Maasai friend listened very closely for a while. Then in his very deep and resonant voice, he spoke in Swahili and asked Salim to come and sit beside him. Then he pointed toward the sky with his spear and said, "Do you see those stars up there?" They were sitting outside in one of the quiet Nairobi suburbs. The sun had set already, and the stars in the sky were brilliant and sparkling. Salim said, "Yes, I see the stars." And the Maasai warrior continued, "There's an interesting phenomenon you must learn about. When you complain about your life and how horrible it is, when your mind is full of all kinds of angry things, look up at the heavens and the stars. Look and see what happens, and you'll find that nothing happens, because the stars don't really care." Then the warrior looked up at the sky and complained and muttered and felt sorry for himself for a few moments, all in a slang dialect of the Swahili language. And then he fell silent. Both he and Salim were watching the stars. Sure enough, nothing happened. Suddenly the warrior smiled. Suddenly he spread his arms as if embracing the whole night sky. And he said, "But here's what's really fascinating. If you embrace your life with joy, just as it is, if you go in the direction that your heart really leads you, all the stars in heaven will line up for you. All the stars will listen to you and be your allies." Even as a young boy, Salim was aware that what his friend was saying was like a powerful seed. It was planted then, and over the years its meaning has continued to grow. In fact, Salim told me that at some of the most important moments of his life, he's remembered what was said to him by his Maasai friend. He's remembered that the stars will line up for you if you embrace and celebrate your life. I consider this a very moving and powerful story. I believe its message. Yet I also believe someone else might say the story is nonsense. The stars don't line up no matter what you say to them or how you look at them. This kind of person might say, "Here, let's do an experiment. You look up at the stars with love in your heart and we'll see if they line up. See, nothing happened. They didn't line up. You lose, I win." There are certainly many people who would have had that point of view, and I can't really say that it's wrong. What I can say is that it's very incomplete. It's very limited. But that limited viewpoint has also had a great deal of power and influence in our society. For me, the idea that the stars will line up for us if we come to them with a joyful heart makes perfect sense. It means that through our attention and intention, we can participate in the conscious energy field. It means we can establish our being in the cosmic dance. And when our being is established in the cosmic dance, that's when we start to experience coincidence and synchronicity. When our being is established in the cosmic dance, that's when the probability amplitudes start to bend. Unusual things start to happen. You think of someone and they call you on the phone. You go to another city, you're looking for a friend, you step out of an elevator and your friend is standing there. You desire something and you're given it, your thoughts begin to manifest into reality. Through coincidence, a conspiracy of improbabilities starts to happen around you all the time. Improbabilities conspire to fulfill your intention. That's what you can look forward to when you master synchronicity. The I Ching is both a book and a technique of prophecy and self-understanding. I Ching means Book of Change, and it was created in China roughly 5,000 years ago. The philosophy that underlies the I Ching views the universe as always changing, and that universe, of course, includes the human race as well, including whoever happens to be reading the I Ching at a given moment. That person may gain some insight into himself or herself, but a week later that person will no longer be the same individual. So the I Ching is like a camera that provides a snapshot of who you are and the world you live in at a specific instant of time. It also provides insight into the future, but without any guarantees, because the future, after all, changes just like anything else. Since there's not enough time here to discuss the mechanics of the I Ching in detail, I'll describe how it works in very simple terms. I hope you'll make an effort on your own to learn more about this very interesting and very philosophical book. Basically, the I Ching describes how to configure and interpret a number of images composed of six lines, one line on top of the other. Some of the lines are broken and some are unbroken. The images are called hexagrams, and there are 64 of them, from which are generated 4,096 mathematically exact interrelationships. To use the I Ching, you begin by formulating a question. It can be a question about a relationship or about your work. It can be about your health or it can be about the future. It can be about yourself or about someone else. It's best to write the question down. Then you toss some coins, or in the authentic version, some wooden rods marked with symbols which direct you to create the hexagram that responds to your question. Once the hexagram has been created, the text of the I Ching provides interpretations. But since these interpretations are often quite poetic and ambiguous, the interpretations themselves are subject to interpretation. In short, the I Ching can give you an answer to almost any question, but not necessarily an easy answer. At this point, you may wonder what all of this has to do with synchrodestiny. To answer this question, it can be useful to think of the I Ching as a metaphor for life itself, for how we experience life over the course of our time on Earth. We come into life with a number of things already in place. This is dharma, which is our purpose in life. And there is karma, which is the transgenerational memories and interpretations and conditioning that we are born with. In a sense, dharma and karma are energizers. They're sources of motivation for our life's journey. They correspond to the question that we put to the I Ching. Just as the question is the starting point for using the Book of Change, our dharma and our karma are the starting points of our lives. So we ask the I Ching a question, and what do we get? By throwing the coins or the rod, we receive directions that allow us to create one of the 64 hexagrams. The hexagram is simply six lines generated on top of one another. Some lines are broken in the center and others are not. By itself, the hexagram means nothing. We can stare at it for as long as we like, and the six lines will tell us nothing about the question we wish to have answered. However, each of the 64 hexagrams is linked to a number of poetic insights and prophecies. These are the interpretations of the hexagrams. But as I mentioned earlier, the interpretations themselves are far from straightforward, particularly since each hexagram includes just a single interpretation, but a combination of six of them, one for each line of the hexagram. You can probably see by now that using the I Ching is far from a simple matter, but I think this is a big part of the reason that the book has endured for so many thousands of years. I've said that the I Ching is a metaphor of life, and that's the question we ask. That the question we ask is analogous to our karmic and dharmic identities. The hexagram, then, is like the self we inhabit during our time on earth. When we first see the hexagram that our question has led us to, we don't know what it means, or if it means anything at all. In the same way, we don't know what our lives mean. We don't know who we really are, or who we were meant to be, until we pass through a process of enlightenment and transformation. This can take many years, it can take an entire lifetime, and it can also happen quite quickly and suddenly. In any case, the journey toward enlightenment in our real lives parallels the poetic interpretations of the hexagram that the I Ching provides. If we study these interpretations with full attention and with an open heart, we can then look at the hexagram with a new understanding. We realize that this little diagram that seemed so meaningless before really does contain the answer to the question we've put to the I Ching. In the same way, if we pass through life with awareness and sensitivity, we can come to understand who we really are and what we are meant to do. Just as the hexagram acquires new meaning once we understand the interpretation, so we can become meaningful to ourselves if we learn from the events of our lives, if we evolve and transform ourselves as a result of the things that happen to us. In other words, if we transcend the limits of our karmic conditioning and achieve a new level of enlightenment. Once we do this, things that seemed meaningless before now are full of significance. And one of the most important areas in which this transformation shows itself is in our ability to recognize, understand, and use synchronistic events. In our ability to see how coincidences are not just interesting novelties, but are really omens, signs that come to us from the source of the universe itself. You can only imagine that which is karmically part of your program, because what is not part of your karmic program is beyond your imagination. So the limits of your imagination are a very important element of who you are. What you imagine has a great deal to do with the reality you inhabit. Imagination, intention, reality, past, present, future, all these concepts are built into your karmic conditioning. How they express themselves, how they manifest themselves in your life is also a function of that conditioning. It's your task, it's all of our tasks, to transform ourselves to a higher level of consciousness so that ultimately the realities of our lives become one with spirit. And the goal in the end is freedom. That's what we're all really after. That's why we're doing all of this. All genuine spiritual pursuits are really pursuits of freedom, or what is called liberation in Sanskrit, the word moksha. Now, what do freedom and liberation really mean? They mean you have the power to direct your awareness where you want to, when you want to, how you want to, so that you're totally grounded in complete freedom. Freedom comes from having this certainty that your awareness can go anywhere you want. That in reality, you are unconditioned, unlimited, eternal awareness. You are not drawn in by criticism or praise or financial situations or whatever. You know the power of those things only derives from your intention and awareness of them. And you have total freedom over your intention and awareness. So you may sometimes get distracted, but that's all it is. You get distracted, but you don't get preoccupied. Because you have the freedom to redirect your awareness. You can always say to yourself, this has no reality, it's only a passing thing. Using the I Ching is a ritual, and that's one of the most important reasons that it's so powerful. Ritual is simply a way of focusing awareness. That's all it is. You go into a courthouse and you put your hand on the Bible and say, I solemnly swear. That's the ritual. It focuses your awareness on what you're doing. So that it's not just a casual act while you're thinking about something else. So ritual is very important. Very, very important. It's the best means for releasing emotions. And it's also the best way to anchor yourself. If you really want to etch something into your consciousness, go through a ritual so that every time you think of the ritual, you're anchored into memory and experience. Right now, I'd like to introduce an exercise that combines the idea of ritual with the idea of an omen, as we've been discussing. It involves the shifting of perception. That's the purpose of techniques like the I Ching. And that's the real purpose of meaningful coincidence as well. This exercise takes a few minutes. Please sit comfortably in a spot where you won't be disturbed. Let's see if we can go beyond the senses to find a level of experience which is in fact more real than the world of the senses. To begin, please place your right hand in your lap and with the palm open and facing upward. Now look at your hand. Look at it very closely. Try to form a clear mental picture of it. Now close your eyes. Although your eyes are closed, keep looking at your hand in your imagination. Examine the mental image of your hand very closely. Trace familiar lines and feel the texture of the skin, the supple flesh cushioning the submerged hardness of bone. This is the hand your senses report to you, a material object composed of flesh and blood. In this first exercise, we will attempt to go beyond the material expression and give you a different experience of it beyond the reach of your senses. Using only the image of your hand in your mind's eye, imagine that you are examining it through a high-powered microscope whose lens can penetrate the finest fabrics of matter. At the lowest part, you can no longer see smooth flesh. Instead, there's a collection of individual cells, loosely bound and connected tissue. Every cell is a watery bag of proteins that appear as long chains of smaller molecules held together by invisible bonds. Moving closer, you can see separate atoms of hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, which have no solid form at all. They are vibrating ghostly shadows revealed through the microscope as patches of light and dark. You have arrived at the boundary between matter and energy. For the subatomic particles in each atom are not spots or dots of matter. They are more like traces of light left by a 4th of July sparkler waved in the dark. At this level, you see that all things you once took to be solid are just energy trails. As soon as you see one trail, the energy has moved elsewhere, leaving nothing substantial to be touched or seen. Each trail is a quantum event, fleeting, dying out as soon as it is noticed. Now you start sinking even deeper into quantum space. All light disappears, replaced by yawning chasms of emptiness. Far away on the horizon of your vision, you see a last flash, like the farthest, faintest star visible in the night sky. Hold that flash in your mind, for it is the last remnant of matter or energy detectable by any scientific instrument. The emptiness closes in, and you're in a place where not just matter and energy are gone, but space and time as well. You have left behind your hand in the realm of space-time events. You have reached another dimension beyond space and time. There is no such thing as before or after in this region, no concept of big or small. Here, your hand exists before the Big Bang, and it continues to exist after the universe has ended in the heat death of absolute zero. The everyday concept of reality is now meaningless. The trials and tribulations of that reality are also meaningless, as are its rewards and luxuries. Does your hand cease to exist? No, for in crossing the boundary of the dimension, you didn't have to go anywhere. All the crude aspects of perception are still available to you. Your hand still exists, but in many different expressions of itself: quantum, subatomic, atomic, molecular, cellular, all connected to each other by invisible intelligence and to the place where you now find yourself. Each layer is a layer of transformation, completely different from the one above or below it, but only here there is nothing but pure information, pure idea, pure creative potential, and all levels are reduced to their quantum origin. As you keep your eyes closed, let's think about the lessons of this experience. These are the lessons. The three-dimensional body reported by the five senses is a mirage. Every solid particle of matter is composed of more than 99.99% empty space. Even within your own hand, the void between two electrons is proportionately as empty as the space between two galaxies. If you go deep enough into the fabric of matter and energy, you arrive at the origin of the universe. All events in space-time have a common source outside the reality available to our senses. Beyond the quantum, the body exists as pure creative potential, a multi-layered process controlled by intelligence. It is from here that all life springs, and every instance of synchronicity calls our attention to the mystery and wonder of this process, if only we will heed this call. Please open your eyes. When you look at your hand again, you can now examine it with a new understanding. You can discern not only the surface appearance, but the depths of creation from which the appearance arose. In this sense, your own hand can be an omen. Whenever you extend it before you, you can be reminded that the universe itself is your extended body. So wherever your hand reaches, remember that it touches an expression of your own consciousness. Joseph Campbell, who was one of the modern authorities on mythology, said that mythology is truer than history. What we call history is usually just a form of journalism. But mythology really captures the true essence of the consciousness of humanity's collective soul. Because in mythology are all the archetypal energies telling their story of eternal life. Therefore, even in our ordinary everyday lives, our unconscious motivations dwell in the mythical world, which means we do things that are motivated by mythical archetypes, even if we are not aware of this. And the universe itself generates events from these same mythical sources, these same archetypes. Archetypes are states of primal energy, states of magical awareness. If you've ever read any fairy tales, you've probably noticed how often these thoughts revolve around surprising coincidences. Synchronicities are really myths in their own right. When you participate in a meaningful coincidence, it's really like being a character in a magical story. And when you understand synchrodestiny, you're not only an actor in that story, but an author of it too. So beneath the level of our conscious awareness, our unconscious motivations dwell in the mystical world, which means that deep inside us, in our consciousness and in our psyche, there are gods and goddesses in embryo, and they yearn to be born. They yearn to lift us out of the ordinary, the trivial, the mundane level of existence that we can so easily fall into. Somehow we know this without really knowing it, because we act out our unconscious or mystical motivations usually without even bringing them into our conscious awareness. We are oblivious of the magical component of our experience. We think we are awake, but we are really sound asleep. And synchronicity is this little musical wake-up call. What do we lose when we become blind to the mythological presence in our lives? We lose the experience of ecstasy and the experience of mystery. We lose magic. That's why kids join gangs, because gangs have mythology, gangs have ritual, gangs seem to have charismatic leadership, gangs have imagination. So there's a need to really start bringing back myth and magic into our lives. When I talk about omens, when I use colorful terminologies like the conspiracy of improbabilities, that's one thing I'm hoping to accomplish. Synchrodestiny does nothing else. I hope it restores the sense of life that you surely had as a child, the sense that there's always something really mysterious and exciting going on, even if it's behind the scenes most of the time. I hope this program can provide the spark for that kind of experience. But it's up to you to fan the flame. it's up to you to penetrate the conspiracy of improbabilities and to find the hidden treasure that lies behind it. I can assure you that it's very important for you to do so. It's very important for you to undertake that quest, for you to dramatize your life in that way, for you to bring that kind of excitement and even ecstasy into your daily life. Ecstasy, of course, really means getting outside of stasis, outside of the routine reality. Ancient civilizations throughout the world recognized this as an absolute priority, but unfortunately, our priorities have come to be located elsewhere. There's a beautiful poem attributed to King Solomon that describes the experience of ecstasy in very poetic and passionate terms. It says, "You split me and tore my heart open. You filled me with love. You poured your spirit into mine. I knew you as I know myself. My eyes are radiant with your light. My ears delight in your music, and my nostrils are filled with your fragrance. You have made all things new. You have made me see all things shining. You have granted me perfect ease. I have become like paradise." This seems to be addressed to a lover, and I believe it is, but in this case, God is the beloved, and the lover is the universe itself. I'd like to end this session with one more exercise. Or maybe exercise isn't really the right word. It's more like an assignment that I'll ask you to complete over the next 24 hours. It's an assignment that will help you to recognize omens and to use the conspiracy of improbabilities. And no ability is more important to synchrodestiny than this. To begin, I'll just ask you to look around at the environment that you're in at this very moment. Look around it with full attention and awareness. Now pick out a certain detail. It may be the color of the wallpaper of the room you're sitting in. If you're listening to the program in your car, it may be an image on a billboard beside the road or the name of the street you're on. Just pick some visual image and keep it clearly in mind for a moment. Now listen to all the sounds that are in your environment. Is there a conversation going on in the next room? Is there a radio or television playing? Is someone blowing a car's horn? Or is there someone using a loud lawnmower outside your window? Pick out one sound and hold it clearly in mind. Next, pick out some object that's nearby and touch it with your hand. It can be a coin, a book, a piece of candy, or even an animal like a cat or a dog. Whatever it is, touch it with full awareness. Feel its texture. Pay attention to whether it's hard or soft, cold or warm. So you've had three experiences, one of sight, one of sound, and one of touch. Now give each of those experiences a one-word name. If you saw a billboard advertising an airline, for example, you can call that experience United or American or Continental, as the case may be. If your experience of sound was of a car alarm, you can use the word alarm. If you heard a baby crying, you can call it baby or infant. Finally, give your experience of touch a one-word name using the same method. Over the next 24 hours, your assignment is to pay close attention to how those words reappear in your life. And not only the words, but also the memory of the sensory experiences that lie behind them. As you look for those words and sense memories, you'll discover a conspiracy of improbabilities beginning to emerge. You'll discover a series of synchronicities associated with those words and memories. If you turn those words into omens through the power of your intention, I guarantee you, you'll encounter a series of meaningful coincidences derived from those omens over the next 24 hours. This is truly an exercise in using synchrodestiny, and if you undertake it with intention and awareness, you'll find that it's also a step toward enlightenment, a step toward a richer understanding of your life and of how mysterious and magical your life really is.